Accession number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 6.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 6. You moved to Mawaska, Mr. Hawksworth. What was happening to you there?
Well, once we got settled in, the battalion was put on a training footing, full blast. Company training, well, starting with a section training, leading up to platoon training, until they got to company standard. The battalion went out into the desert, in various directions on battalion training exercises, and towards the end of our stay in Mawaska, the battalion was engaged in a desert exercise operation which involved Egyptian army officers, which was interesting to say the least. During this time, I had, I was appointed a temporary officer's mess waiter. I learned how to serve proper measures of sherry in the officer's mess, which is an essential part of my duty, and accompanied the officer's mess truck on this desert exercise, which was interesting, very interesting. After the exercise was completed, that lasting some 2 weeks, we returned to Mawaska garrison and told to prepare for a move elsewhere, which only meant one direction, and that was up towards the desert, the western desert.
Was Mawaska a permanent camp?
Mawaska was a British garrison base, and been there quite some time, and it was quite a good barracks, a substantially built barracks. It was green and pleasant. It was within hailing distance of the Great Bitter Lake, where swimming was absolutely marvellous. Every amenity was in the garrison camp, as one might expect. And having spent a couple of months at Port Said on a rubbish tip, we really enjoyed ourselves there for a while. So, yes, the battalion was busy. Everybody was doing their job as far as training was concerned. They were, in fact, training for war. And we were brushing up on our stretcher bearing role, apart from doing odd jobs as mess waiters and other things. We were now in full knowledge of the fact that we were going to be involved in the real thing, and so we got down to getting ready for it.
How had you could become acclimatised to the weather, which would be different from China?
Well, we in China, of course, we'd been there a couple of years or so, and we'd experienced both extremes. The Egyptian climate is more, it's obviously a Mediterranean climate, much kinder and milder, and so we had no problem adjusting to that extent.
Did you see much of the native Egyptians?
Oh, yes. There were quite a few civvy wallahs employed inside the camp, inside the garrison. Cleaners, street sweepers, cooks and the lonely persons and all. They were the typical Egyptian helpers. Plenty of them, but at the same time, one had to keep one's kit under close supervision.
Had you formed an opinion about the Egyptians as a people?
Well, as I'd previously indicated, I was out on this long desert training exercise, which involved a certain number of Egyptian officers and their batmen or bat persons or whatever they call them now, and I wasn't very impressed. The one thing they seemed to enjoy was the food, and they wanted plenty of it too. Speaking first hand, I was a mess waiter and saw this, but of course first impressions are not always right, so I just thought, oh well, this may be, there's only a few of them here, we'll see what the rest are like.
Did they look as though they could be relied upon as an ally.
Well, I don't think fair comment is forthcoming in reply to that question, because they were acting as supernumeraries to our company commanders, or the supernumeraries to the adjutant, in fact, and CO. In other words, they were officers of similar rank, if not equal, understudying their opposite number, the British officer type. And owing to the language difficulty, they weren't able to issue orders to our people in any case. So they were merely following our chaps around, seeing how it should be done. And I must say that our officers were made them pretty welcome. They certainly had some good mess nights while they were there. Vast quantities of this and that disappeared, I'll tell you. So it's one couldn't really form an opinion as far as the fighting quality, certainly fighting quality concerned, or their attitude towards it. This was soon to come.
Had you had a change in command of the battalion?
Oh, yes. Major Goldsmith took over the battalion in April of 1940. Harry Lowe, our quartermaster, who was a well-known figure in the regiment, let alone the battalion, left and he went to Cairo on a staff job. He became Colonel Quartermaster of British troops in Egypt, a plum job. John Bush, who'd been up to that time our regimental sergeant major, was appointed quartermaster, and Mr. Flanagan, Sergeant Major Flanagan, who was at one time our boys' weapon training instructor in Blackdown, was made regimental sergeant major. So there were a few changes taking place.
Were they good for the battalion?
Oh, definitely, yes. They proved their worth in peacetime, they proved their worth during the mobilisation period, and they were all sound fellas. Indeed, they were. John Bush was a very popular regimental sergeant major, and he became a very popular and efficient quartermaster. It was a sad day when we lost him on the Dodecanese Island. George Flanagan, who had been a very good friend of my uncle, John Rosendale, in the battalion, was a well-known man, a fair man, and he let it be known that he'd become the regiment sergeant major, as is right and proper.
Were there any other NCOs within your own experience in the battle that were you particularly liked and got on well with and were respected?
Well, all our NCOs were certainly liked and definitely respected. The band, through reason of the close proximity in which we worked, were more of a family than an ordinary rifle platoon, which after all is even split into sections. We were a body of maybe 40 odd people, more than 50 were the bugles, who considered themselves to be musical, although certain people thought otherwise. So we were more or less of a family unit, and we not only respected our NCOs, but we did like them. One name comes to mind of Corporal Smurthwaite, the bassoonist. The bassoon's known as the comedian of the orchestra, as most people know, and at that time I was doing my best to learn it unofficially. Smurthwaite was also known as the band comedian. And in later years, we met up with Corporal Smurthwaite, who was then a captain in the field security police, when we passed through Hong Kong on our way to Korea. Unfortunately, sometime later, he died of a strange illness. But Corporal Smurthwaite, our humorous bassoonist, certainly springs to mind.
You were moved up the desert. When did this happen?
We left Mwaska in July 1940 and moved up in a creaky convoy, some by rail, to Merthyr Matruh, an Egyptian barracks almost on the sea edge, and were soon attended to by the Italian Air Force from a great height.
Did they drop anything?
They dropped a lot. I can't remember whether it was the second or third day there, but we by that time had been posted out to our respective companies as stretcher bearers proper, two per company, and I was kept in the regimental aid post with three of my comrades in arms to look after the regimental aid post with a medical officer. We'd gone into the barracks about a half a mile distance on a certain duty when the air raid alarm was sounded, the hand-operated klaxon, and in no time, from nowhere, the bombs started to drop. We since learned that the Italians were flying at something like 25,000 feet, so how the hell they found us, God only knows. We had no, I think we had little ACAC protection. There were two or three Bofors on a ridge some distance away, but a Bofor gun can't fire at that height. So we were not only bombed, we suffered casualties. Certainly half a dozen severely injured. And during this raid, at least one of our stretcher bearers, acting as he should and under bombardment, was awarded an immediate military medal for succouring a wounded colour sergeant.
Do you remember who that was?
Hatton was his name. I think it, there were two brothers in the battalion. One was a sergeant and one was a colour sergeant. And I think it was colour sergeant Hatton. I wouldn't be, one of the Hatton brothers certainly suffered a severe wound in his back from a bomb splinter. And the stretcher bearer who attended him and received his immediate award was a chap called Owen, O-W-E-N, military medal. Stretcher bearers are not often awarded a warfare gallantry because it's after all part of the job. But this chap, like all of us, never suffered under an air attack or anything like it previously. He just went instinctively to this fellow's aid out of the trench and started bandaging him up.
What are your feelings as bombs are dropping around you? Because there's nothing much you can do about it.
Well, in hindsight, I realised, as I was eventually told, that the first thing you're supposed to do, or the safest thing to do, if you're caught in an aerial bombardment, wherever you are, is to lie flat. But we weren't on the desert floor. We were actually in a target area. It was a barracks. And I might, at this juncture, I might pose the question, who was a brainless idiot who put it into a target area on a first day near the line? However, that's a question that will remain unanswered. We were all scared out of our wits. There were slit trenches. The first thing we did when we arrived there were dig slit trenches around the place. But it was, after all, aiming at barrack blocks. It's like sticking a bayonet into the bull of a target that you can't miss. So these Italians, although they were up a height and almost out of sight, dropped the load where it was intended, and we suffered resultantly.
Did you see any men who broke under this bombardment?
No. There was no panic. People were, shortly afterwards, were visibly shaking, in fact. Not excluding myself, I might add. But I, during this air raid, which lasted some 20 minutes or so, was in this shelter with an overhead cover of a sheet of corrugated tin, which wasn't bomb-proof, I'm sure. And one of the characters in this trench was a cook named Bogue, B-O-A-G. I think it was a corporal. And as we realised that the last bombs had been dropped and the stretcher bed had been called for, Bogue's remark to all and sundry was, "Well, we better get the bloody dinner on again." So off he went.
In between the bombing and whilst you were in Mers Matru, what kind of duties were you doing?
Well, we were We were bothered usually twice a day by the Italians from the air, by which time, of course, we'd afforded ourselves better protection, better trenches, and a bit of overhead cover. And only essential people were allowed to remain in the actual barrack buildings, and eventually they were all withdrawn to a perimeter place. We, meanwhile, were in another rather precariously situated position. The regimental aid post was in a triangular piece of land surrounded by a railway on two sides and a road on the third. An obvious aiming mark. It was a crossroad. A strange place for a regimental aid post, one must admit. However, there were a medical officer was in residence, Major Jock Lees, later a military crossman, Sergeant McNally, the medic sergeant, Private Milligan, Private Temple, and Private Horsworth. We had now become privates because we were soldiers. And our job was to attend the daily sick parade, affix dressings, dish out tablets, and do our best to rid ourselves of the bloody awful Egyptian fleas which abounded. There was, even those early days, a substance issued in small tins, similar to that of an old-fashioned oval mustard tin, which went under the name of flea powder, a tarry substance resembling brown sugar, which one couldn't dust into one's bedding, but threw it along in lumps. So when you got up in the morning, everybody thought you had war wounds or... My God, it was awful stuff, that. And the fleas loved it. We weren't kept very busy. The sick parade attendance for normal sicknesses was very, very slight. Our worst enemy at that point of the operations was a terrible thing called a desert sore. It seemed that if a person cut himself, and our chaps by that time had taken up compositions on the outer perimeter of Merzimetru, were digging defensive positions, and of course cut themselves occasionally with picks and shovels, as people will. And it seemed, as I say, that septicemia set in straight away. As soon as the chap got an open wound and the sand got there, it became a sore, not an ordinary sore, but a terrible wound, a gaping wound. I have in mind that our medical officer invented the cure. This is how it happened. We're at our wit's end to treat these things until the arrival of a new drug in the form of a pill called M&B. 693. 693, I believe, stands for the fact that some 693 families of rats were used in the experiments before it was processed. Jock Lees one day attended the Pioneer Platoon Sergeant Major, whose name I can't remember for the moment, who had a terrible sore on his knee. "Fetch me some M&B tablets," said he, "sulfanilamide." And he ground up four or five of these tablets into a fine powder, ringed the wound with Vaseline, poured this powder onto the open wound, ordered me to bandage it, and gave this soldier strict instructions not to remove the bandage, just to let it rot off. And 7 months later, I saw this chap swimming in the sea, and he had a pale pink scar where the sore had been. So sulfanilamide cured that. And thereafter, we made our own ointment until it appeared in chew form. Desert sores.
You said that the battalion moved out to dig defences. Do you recall what form those defences took?
Yes. As one comes into the small town of Merzimetru from the outer road from Port Sedway, you come to the brow of a hill and then down into the town. From the top of the hill toward the sea, there runs a ridge in which there are various tombs which were constructed in years and years and years ago, one of which was later occupied by our medical people. But the rifle companies were posted on the forward side of this ridge, down toward the sea, and astride the road which led up toward Sidivarani, and were preparing ordinary infantry defensive positions, which consisted of firing pits, slit trenches, communication trenches, and they were later assisted by Royal Engineer field construction companies digging great holes in the ground, which were later to become underground shelters, bunks, or as we used to call them in Korea, hutches. Not necessarily proof from a direct bomb, but certainly good protection against shell fire and shell splinters, bomb splinters. And so quite a lot of the time at Natru was spent by the Geordies digging these positions, which were later occupied to some and put to good use when the offensive murder Natru took place by some Geordie battalions.
Mirza Matru is quite famous in the history of the Second World War in the desert. What exactly was it like?
Well, I might get wrong by various tourist operators for saying this, but as far as I'm concerned, it was an Egyptian hick town. One might have expected a sheriff on a mule to ride down the main and one only street any time of day or night. But in fact, I'm led to believe it was a favourite watering place for the Egyptian hierarchy. Of whom there were many. Joking apart, one can imagine it in peacetime, when it was clean and unaffected by aerial bombardment and whatever, to be quite a pleasant little place. It was right on the sea, right on the coast. It was surrounded on one side by a huge range of white sand hills, which were nice to see in the moonlight. The bathing was absolutely out of this world. There was certainly no oil pollution out there in those days. It had its own mosque. And incidentally, after every air raid, one or two Geordies would be heard to say, "They're in that bloody mosque, you know." Because whilst we were there, most of the Egyptians had fled in the direction of Alexandria and boarded up their little tin shack shops. Of course, it was no different as far as the Egyptians are concerned from two or three of our smaller seaside holiday resorts. You don't expect substantial facades on shops and things in those locations. So I can quite well imagine it. And in fact, as it is today, it's got itself back into prominence now, and it's a well sought after holiday spot. But as far as we were concerned, murder me through with a dirty word. We didn't want to be there any longer than necessary, and the sooner they moved us up, the better it was as far as we were concerned. However, we were by then posted out to the companies who had installed themselves in the newly prepared positions, and we were quite content to work it out.
How were this? Was the stretcher bearers platoon organised within the battalion?
Well, once our rifle companies had got themselves, as I previously indicated, into their proper positions, instructions were then issued to the stretcher bearers to join the companies previously to which they had been previously allocated, two per company, and I was allotted to C Company, with one of the other stretcher bearers, David Milligan, who were in a position codenamed Old Reeky. Every company by this time, therefore, had their own two stretcher bearers with the proper equipment, two stretchers, one collapsible and one conventional. We each had and carried at all times our haversack containing 20 shell dressings. Field dressings were an individual responsibility, of course, but that's all we did carry. Some people seem to think we were walking around like battlefield surgeons, which is far from the truth. The very essence of a first aider's job is to render first aid and make the person ready for subsequent surgical attention. Shell dressings, of course, it's quite a large pack, and we used a good effect, I'm afraid, on numerous occasions. But this is what we carried.
There was no ointments or drugs, anything of that nature.
No, we were not allowed to carry any additional medicaments, lotions, potions, or anything of that nature. And in fact, it was an offence so to do. Although I do know for a fact that it's in certain instances, several of our chaps had their own private box with aspirin, or in fact, I think I did at times. But it wasn't a done thing. It wasn't a union rule, of course. We didn't have any in those days. But the medical officer needed to know the general state of health of the soldiers, and it wasn't our job to steal his thunder. So that's how we went about it. We wore a white armband with the letters SB in red on our arms when we were about our business. But as I've said, no matter where we were or wherever we went, we were in possession of our haversack containing these shell dressings.
Did you carry weapons?
No. If we wore our badge and carried our bag, we were unarmed. We were allowed to carry an arm, a weapon of some sort, if you're going to the aid of a person who needed first aid. We were not Red Cross people, we were regimental stretcher bearers. But in any case, the very fact that we may be called upon to carry stretchers meant that the presence of a rifle or any other similar encumbrance would have been an embarrassment, to say the least. So no, we were essentially unarmed.
Within the company position, did you have your own dugout or place?
Yes, we were well treated, we were well respected, I suppose, being the local quack, so to speak. The company officer made sure that we had adequate accommodation, and we by that time knew most of the company, in any case, by first name. And so we were well looked after, and we were ready to give our services as and when required. So, yes, we were. We were well sought. Well looked after.
Who was C Company Commander?
God. Company Commander of our company, C Company at that time, was Adrian Keith. And the Sergeant Major, I remember well, was Sergeant Major Billy Birch. Quite a good company. Quite a good company. Not situated in the most enviable position. Once again, it seemed that wherever we took up occupation, we were in an extremely vulnerable situation. Well, then that's what war's all about. We were in fact ranged along a water gully on the edge of the airstrip.
So you got a bit of bombing attention.
No, the Italians thought it was. I think the Italians thought it was far too bloody obvious, so they avoided us like the plague and dropped us elsewhere.
Did the battalion suffer heavily in Mersa Matruh?
No. It would be wrong to say that we did. We had our casualties. We had accidents. One can imagine with mine laying by this time was taking place. Mine panels were being put out. And I personally attended one fatality when someone discarded a mine not in the fashion laid down, and unfortunately caused the death of one of the RE sappers. And so, yes, there were casualties, but there were accidents also. But not a great number, I would say.
How did you take yourself personally to men with rather horrible wounds or blood or dying first time?
Well, we've been told from a long time previously, when we started training as stretcher bearers, as far back as Shanghai days, that no matter what was said in the classroom, and no matter what was done on the practical side elsewhere, indoors or out, when the real thing happened, we'd feel it possibly much as the injured person. And my first job, I was called upon to attend to a chap whose leg had been almost severed, not a pleasant sight, and I hung back for a few seconds possibly, until I realised I was acting silly buggers, and then I got cracking. But it's not a pleasant job. It's like an ambulance man job, I suppose. It's terrific accidents happen now. But when a person's been nearly blown apart by a bomb or a shell, it's a terrifying experience. But then, gradually, we not only had to accept it as a way of life, it was our job to to look after once it had happened. So it wasn't a pleasant job, but we became, I suppose, the word is hand to it. We knew that that's what we were there for, and we had to do what we could for them.